Hi, and welcome back to Give Us More. I'm Niamh.
I'm Megan.
And today we are finally recording the safest way possible.
We figured it out!
We think. Look, it's going to sound a bit different because we're recording in two different households via phone and tablets and whatnot.
Yeah, this is a janky ass setup. Oh, so no. We are calling each other like an actual phone call while we record separate files, and then she's gonna send her file to me, and we're gonna
work some magic.
Hopefully.
Yeah, so we're trying to do it as safe as possible because shit is getting scary out there.
Super scary. I'm fucking terrified.
Yeah.
I'm probably more scared than I was the first lockdown in March of 2020.
I think especially because I don't know about the rest of the world, but over here, I feel like the first time around, it wasn't really anybody that I knew. But now I know several people who have got it, and like others who are getting tested and got tested.
Yeah.
So it's like...
Exactly.
Scary.
But anyway, like we said before, we're bringing you straight fire for 2021. And Niamh has a great case for us to... Niamh has a great case for us this week.
Yeah, I'm super, super excited to do. It's a case that I actually am very, very interested in. And already kind of knew a lot of. So I'm just going to give a little warning because in this case, there is mention of domestic violence. And I know that can be very triggering to people. Of course, there is natural, there's murder. Dun, dun, dun.
What, on a true crime podcast? Excuse me.
Yeah, but there is mention of domestic violence. And I know that can be very triggering. So I just wanted to let everybody know. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I was trying to keep suspense there. If you guessed it before I... said
the
it.
The title, Niamh.
Today I'm going to be doing the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson.
Straight fire.
Yeah.
Straight fire.
Yeah. So this case is about Nicole Brown Simpson. It is not about OJ, okay?
Yes, that's what we love.
Yeah, he gets talked about all the time. What about Nicole? Okay, she deserved so much better. So
way better.
Yeah. Nicole Brown was born on May 19th, 1959 in Frankfurt, West Germany, to Juditha Ann Judy Brown and to Louis Lou Ezekiel Brown. Her mother was German and her father was an American who was stationed out in Germany as a correspondent for the American Armed Forces publication Stars and Stripes.
Ooh.
Which I feel like
I know nothing about that, whatever that is, I don't know.
I just feel like it's a very American name.
It's always.
Yeah. Her parents got married and they had two children, if I'm correct, Nicole being one of them. And her parents then decided to move to the States, where they settled in Garden Grove, California. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, wait, we have to do it. I don't think we've done this since episode 3. California.
In the city.
California.
That is a jam. Nicole had three sisters, whom of which she was all very close with. So her mother and father went on to have two other children when they moved to California. So, yeah. Nicole attended Rancho Alamitos High School in Garden Grove. I hope I said that right. She was described as being a very bubbly young girl who had many friends. She was considered the beautiful blonde. Mm-hmm. She'd won homecoming queen. And she got along with almost everybody. Nobody really had any bad words to say about her.
Yeah.
Nicole then graduated from Dana Hills High School in Dana Point in 1977. After she graduated, she started working as a waitress in a very exclusive club called the Daisy in Beverly Hills. She had just turned 18. She was fresh out of school, just turned 18. And this is where she met the very famous 30-year-old OJ Simpson.
Wasn't he in Police Academy?
Oh, I actually don't know. I know he was an actor. He did have roles and stuff in movies and TV shows. I don't know if he was actually in Police Academy or not. Speaking of OJ, I'm just going to give you a little background on him. Orenthal James Simpson was born July 9th, 1947 in San Francisco, California, to Eunice and Jimmy Lee Simpson. Later on in life, OJ's father would actually come out as gay and would become a very well-known drag queen in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh my gosh!
Kill it, cool. Jimmy Lee. Kill it.
Yeah.
OJ had one brother and two sisters, one of which had actually sadly passed away. Mm. As a child, OJ had rickets and would have to wear braces on his legs until he was five. In his early teenage years, he actually joined a street gang and was briefly incarcerated.
Wait. Yeah. Hold on a second. Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Don't you get rickets from a lack of vitamin D?
Probably.
Like, and that's, he's called OJ? Orange juice?
I know,
lack
yeah.
of?
Yeah.
No? Maybe I'm completely wrong. But anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, OJ was his nickname because he was Orenthal James. Yeah, when he, in his early teenage years, he joined a street gang and was briefly incarcerated at a youth facility. His first wife would say that during this time, he was a, quote, really awful person then. Baseball star by the name of Willie Mays encouraged OJ to actually get his act together. And so at Galileo High School, he joined the football team, which started off what would be an amazing and successful career in football. At the age of 19, OJ married his high school sweetheart, Marguerite, on June 24th, 1967. The couple would have three children, but sadly the youngest would pass away in a drowning accident in the family's pool in 1979, which is really sad.
That's awful.
Yeah, that is really sad. OJ was still married to his first wife when he met Nicole, but this did not stop him from hitting on her.
Ooh, scandalous.
Nicole and OJ started dating pretty much immediately after they met at the Daisy. In an interview, OJ said that, like, he just saw her and was like, I have to get to know her. Like, she is just beautiful. OJ then divorced his first wife in March 1979. So they met in 1977, OJ and Nicole.
Oh.
Yeah, and then 2 years later, he divorced his wife. Now, they had separated, like, previous to that. Nicole and OJ moved in together pretty much after that, and Nicole was about 19 years of age.
Oh, what? And how old was OJ?
OJ was 30 when they met, so when she turned 19, he was 31. The pair got married on February 2nd, 1985, 5 years after he retired from professional football.
Mm-hmm.
The couple had two children together, Sydney and Justin Ryan. Nicole was a very hands-on mother to her children. She hated the thought of nannies raising her kids, and she wanted to be there for them whenever they needed her. OJ was is quoted saying in an interview that she was, quote, too attentive.
Excuse me? Yeah. Sir?
Yeah.
They're your children. Get a fucking life.
Yeah. She was a very bubbly woman who welcomed anyone who walked into her home with open arms. Nicole then started an interior decorating business as her career choice. Kill it! Nicole and OJ's marriage, however, was anything but picture perfect.
Right. That was very snapped of you again, Niamh.
Thank you. My goal is to be unsnapped. Not for, like, being the woman who snapped, for, like, you know, investigating it. I don't want to be the woman that snapped. OJ had been unfaithful to Nicole on many occasions, and he was also physically abusive to her. Family and friends have talked many times about seeing her with bruises all over her body, and Nicole on many occasions actually had to call the police on OJ.
Good Lord. Yeah. What the fuck is wrong with this man?
Even just by the time I finish this paragraph, you'll be like, fuck him. So, most notably was after the pair had been at a New Year's Eve party in 1989, things just got super bad. So, at the party, he was overheard telling Nicole that he was going to kill her.
What?
So, they got back to the house and Nicole and OJ got into a fight and she ended up having to call 911. When police arrived at the house, Nicole was hiding in a bush outside, half naked, scared for her life.
Oh my god.
Yeah, she had a black eye and she had OJ's handprints all around her neck. She pleaded with the police to help her, telling them, he is going to kill me.
What?
Yeah, and you've been here 8 times and you never do anything. He is going to kill me.
Oh, stop it. You're breaking my fucking heart. What the hell?
Yeah. The police arrested OJ and he pleaded no contest, but despite this, he actually only served a handful of hours in community service.
Yeah, what year was this?
1989.
I think it was only like the 70s that like domestic abuse was really recognised as a crime.
Mm.
So, you know, we're not long after that. They're probably still don't really know how to handle it.
Yeah, well, this is it. And you can, like, there is audio out there of some of her 911 calls, and they are absolutely heartbreaking.
Horrifying. I can only imagine. I don't want to fucking hear that. That's, giving me shivers.
I know, yeah. Nicole's father apparently, now this is apparently, I don't know how true it is, but Nicole's father apparently pushed her to forgive OJ and give him another chance, as OJ had actually bought the father a Hertz dealership, and so, you know, the dad was like, you know, he treats us all well. Like, he just made a mistake.
Oh, yeah, he made a mistake 8 times or more. Fuck that. Oh, there's more.
Yeah. So Nicole did forgive him. But however, Nicole finally had enough and she separated from OJ in 1992, filing for divorce, stating irreconcilable differences.
Yes.
Yes. Now, the pair couldn't actually seem to stay away from each other too long and were about to give it another go until Nicole had to call police once again in 1993. When police arrived, she told them that and this is a quote, "He gets a very animalistic look in him. All his veins pop out. His eyes are black. Just black. I mean cold, like an animal. I mean very, very weird. And when I see it, it scares me."
Oh my god. Like, I feel scared for her. And then the fact that even though he didn't go to prison for her murder and he's still walking around, like, doing whatever he wants, even though he's a fucking woman beater. OJ, yeah. Like, I hope snakes bite you between your toes and shit. I don't know.
I know. Nicole finally split from Nicole. She split from herself. She did not. Nicole finally split from OJ one last time, and this time it was for good. After the divorce, Nicole won a settlement of $433,000 and $10,000 a month in child support. She began driving a white Ferrari and started to go out with her friends, dancing, and she was really enjoying her newfound single life.
Yeah.
She was, like, living it up. However, it is claimed that OJ stalked her. He would follow her to restaurants and clubs with the excuse that, like, oh, he just happened to go to the same restaurant with his friends and, like, things like that.
I can't. Like, I just can't.
I know. She began to take note of this and had told her mother about how it scared her. Quote, "I go to the gas station. He's there. I'm driving and he's behind me." Like, what the fuck? Nicole kept journals detailing every abusive encounter she ever had with OJ, along with pictures and evidence, and she kept them all safely in a safety deposit box.
Smart woman.
Yep. She told family and friends about this in case anything ever happened to her.
Oh.
And she had told family and friends several times, like, he is going to kill me one day.
Yeah. Sure, he told her he would.
Yeah. On June 7th, 1994, Nicole called a woman's shelter looking for help, stating that she was being abused by her ex-husband. So are you ready for this? It's absolutely disgusting.
Not sure, but go on.
In total, there was about 52 incidents of domestic violence, and the police had been called 9 times, resulting in OJ only ever being arrested the once.
Once. Yep. One time.
One time.
For beating somebody black and fucking blue.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yep. Nicole had also reported that a set of her house keys had gone missing from her home. And, like, literally, as I said, like, she would tell family and friends, like, he is going to kill me. Like, if I die, it's him.
Oh, imagine, like, having that behind, like...
That, like...
It was the same with Susan Powell. Like, Susan knew that Josh was going to kill her, and... Lo and behold, and he probably, like, fucking did. Not that we know, but, like...
Not that we'll ever fully know, but yeah.
And it's the same with OJ. We'll never fully know.
I'd say he'll admit it on his deathbed, personally.
I don't know. I think his ego's too big.
His ego is definitely far too big, but... On Sunday, June 12th, 1994, Nicole and OJ's daughter had a recital at her school, and I don't know why I said daughter like that. Daughter. What's wrong with me? Daughter.
It's because we're out of sync.
It is. I feel so weird right now. Because I'm not like
it's so
looking,
weird.
Yeah, I'm not looking at your face and I miss it.
Oh, I miss your face too. No.
Can everybody just do what they're supposed to do so me and Megan can record again properly?
Yeah. That'd be super great.
We need to be able to record.
For the content that nobody listens to.
With the content that only we enjoy. Afterwards, Nicole and her family went to a restaurant called Mezzaluna, where Nicole's friend Ron Goldman worked. After they finished their meal and left, Nicole called Ron asking if he could bring her mother's glasses around to the house as the mother had accidentally left them on the restaurant table. Ron, of course, had no problem with this and was like, yeah, sure, no thing, you got it. The pair supposedly met about 6 weeks prior to this night at Mezzaluna. They had become really good friends and enjoyed going out with each other. Now, there's speculation on if they were more than just friends or not, but Ron's friends were like, no, like, he was just really good friends with her, like, he just got along with her really well, and they just enjoyed each other's company, and it was nothing more. So, yeah. Between 10:15 p.m. and 11 p.m, an unknown assailant attacked Nicole, 35, and Ron Goldman, 25, outside Nicole's home in Brentwood, Los Angeles. The attacker had stabbed Nicole 7 times in the neck and scalp. She had a 14-centimeter gash across her neck, which severed her right and left jugular. The attacker had left her almost decapitated.
Oi.
Yeah. She had defense wounds on her hands and a very large bruise on her back, which would be consistent with the attacker placing a foot on her back and pulling her head back using her hair to cut her throat.
Oh, my days. That's horrific.
Yep. It's believed by police that Ron had arrived either as the assailant began attacking Nicole or moments afterwards. His family would like to think that, you know, he died trying to save Nicole's life. It's also believed that it is his voice witnesses heard yelling roughly around the time of the murders.
That's rough. So I'd say more than likely the alleged attacker, whoever that may possibly be.
Whoever.
Yeah, who knows? So that would say to me that they killed Nicole first and left Ron to watch, more or less.
It's so what I think most of the like forensic people believe is that Ron arrived as the attacker was attacking Nicole, and the attacker like drifted between Ron and Nicole, so like, because Nicole was most likely unconscious, so that then he started attacking Ron and then went back to Nicole.
Ew.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
It is horrible. So Ron was stabbed multiple times in the body and neck. It's believed that the attacker held Ron in a chokehold with one arm while stabbing him with the other hand. Ron also had defense wounds on his arms and hands. Their bodies had not been discovered until sometime after midnight, after a neighbor found Nicole's dog walking around the neighborhood with blood in his paws, but had no wounds. So,
oh, Jesus.
Yeah, so the neighbor was like, that's weird. So then the dog actually led the neighbor back to the scene. And obviously when the neighbor seen the scene, he actually managed to flag down a passing patrol car. Nicole,
convenient.
Right? Like, what good timing. Nicole was found at the bottom of the stairwell that led to her front door, which had been left open. However, there was no signs of forced entry or any evidence to suggest someone entered the home.
Right.
There was an unawful amount of blood all over the crime scene. However, none at the bottom of Nicole's feet, which suggests that she was murdered first and therefore was the intended victim.
Murdered first or knocked out. She wasn't standing anyway.
Yeah, she wasn't standing anyway. So they reckon that leads then to the conclusion that she was the intended victim. The attacker had dropped a blue knit cap and a left hand glove in extra large Aris Isotoner light leather. That was the make and size of the glove. There was also shoe prints leading away from the crime scene, which actually indicated that whoever the attacker was strolled away and didn't run. They could tell by, like, the distance of the feet.
Yeah.
There was also an indication that the attacker had injured a finger on their left hand, as there was blood spots along with the footprints.
Okay.
Ron would be buried at Pierce Brothers Valley Oaks Memorial Park, and Nicole's funeral was held on June 16th in Brentwood with mourners, including some of Nicole's closest friends, like Chris Kardashian. And OJ was there. OJ was there with his two children. And it is said that he leant into the coffin and whispered something to Nicole before walking away.
Ugh. Knowing that fucking freak, he probably said something like, I got you, or something like that.
You made me do this. Because they always blame the victim. So, the next portion of this, can I just say, is absolutely fucking wild.
Right, okay.
Like, this is low-key what got me interested in this case, because I just am, like, astonished. And then information about the trial get you riled, and you're like, fuck! And then the ending is somewhat disappointing, but also laughable, so... It's wild. Okay, it's wild.
Okay.
So, OJ had been scheduled to take a red-eye flight that the night of the murders to Chicago for a golf tournament. The limo driver, Alan Park, was scheduled to collect OJ and bring him to the airport. However, he arrived earlier than scheduled at 10:25 p.m. so that he could navigate his way around the grounds of OJ's estate. Yeah. Alan, which is like, you know, go Alan, you are a top-notch worker. Alan testified that when he arrived, OJ's white Ford Bronco was not at the house. Alan tried both entrances to the estate to see which would be easier to access with the limo before deciding on the Rockingham entrance. Because he lived in a fucking mansion, so... There was like two entrances. One was like the west something, and then one was Rockingham entrance. So that's the one that Alan decided on would be better access. At 10:40 p.m. he began buzzing to be let up the driveway, but there was no answer. He testified that the house was in complete darkness and it almost looked like no one was home. He then began to call his boss so that he could try to get a hold of OJ to let him know that he was waiting outside. And this is when Alan saw a figure that fit the profile of OJ. Coming from the south walkway, which is where a bloodied glove would be found by police later on.
Stop!
Yep. The figure entered the home and began turning lights on. At the same time as this, Cato Kalin, who was an actor and close friend of OJ's, and he was staying in OJ's guest house on the estate. He was in the guest house, and at around 10:50 p.m. he heard three loud thumps coming from the walls outside at the back of the guest house. So Cato went out to investigate, but he went to the front of the guest house first. And this is then when he found Alan, the limo driver, waiting to be let in. So Cato opened the gates for Alan to go up the driveway, and as the two got to the front doors of the property, OJ then magically appeared at the front of the door, claiming that he had slept through his alarm. Both Alan and Cato noticed that OJ seemed agitated.
Agitated, yeah, because he's had no sleep, and like, also, who's in your house turning on lights, OJ?
Right. OJ had three bags that he needed put into the car. So Alan took one, and when Cato went to pick up a rucksack-type bag to help out, OJ told him that he was not to touch that bag and that he would put the bag in himself. The limo driver stated that on the way to the airport, OJ just kept going on about how he was sweating and how he was so warm, and even rolled down the window of the limo, even though reportedly it actually wasn't that warm of a night.
Okay.
When OJ got to the airport, he actually only ever checked in two bags. The third bag, which was the rucksack, never found, and nobody knows what happened to it.
What?
Yep. So once the bodies had been properly identified as Nicole and Ron, police went to OJ's estate to inform him of the tragic news about his wife and to let him know that his children were at the police station, as they had actually been asleep inside Nicole's home at the time of the murders. So the police buzzed the gates of the estate for about 30 minutes when they noticed the white Bronco, which, remember, the limo driver said wasn't there. It was all of a sudden there. And when they went towards the white Bronco, they noticed that there was blood on the driver's side door and inside the car. So even though the police didn't have a proper search warrant, the police jumped the fence of the home in fear that someone else had been attacked, just because it was Nicole Simpson that had been murdered. So there was fears that maybe, like, it was somebody out to get the Simpson people. Mm-hmm. So they jumped the fence. They came across Cato, who was staying in the guest house, and they interviewed him. He told them about the three thumps that he had had, that he had heard earlier on in the night. And so the detectives began to search the property. So the police found a right-hand extra large Aris isotoner glove with bloodstains on it, and at the crime scene there was a left hand extra large Aris isotoner glove.
Right, the famous glove.
Suspicious. Cato also informed the detectives that the Bronco belonged to OJ himself. When he was like, oh yeah, no, that's because they were like, who owns the Bronco out front, like there's blood on it on the car. He was like, oh no, that's OJ's, like he owns that Bronco. Detectives finally got a hold of OJ at his hotel where he was staying in Chicago, and they informed him of his ex-wife's murder and the whereabouts of the children. The detective that made the call testified that OJ did seem to be upset about the news of his wife, but strangely wasn't concerned with how she died. He also noted, that OJ asked weird questions, like if the children heard or saw the attacker, and if the children saw Nicole's body. He never once asked if his children had been attacked or if they were okay.
No. So to be honest with you, I feel like if the children had been attacked, that would have been said originally when he was told about Nicole. So maybe he was just like, okay, yeah, they're fine. Like, I'm just playing devil's advocate. Like, he probably assumed they were okay because nothing was said to him in the first place.
I mean, yeah, I get that. Like, I suppose there's no rule book on how you're supposed to react to this, like, this kind of news. I do think, though, like, if I got a phone call to tell me that Cottle was dead, right, and I wasn't in the house, but Anna was, I think I would be like, oh my god, is, like, Anna okay? Did anybody hurt Anna? Yeah, I'd obviously be upset about Cottle, but I'd be more focused on Anna. And then once I knew Anna was okay, then I'd be like, holy fucking shit.
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah. No, that was just something, I don't know.
I know, yeah. I suppose there's no wrong way to be, but the police just found it a bit suspicious.
A bit weird. That's weird. That's suspicious.
Yeah. So OJ took a red eye home, and on Monday, June 13th, OJ flew back home, and as soon as he arrived home, he went down to the police station to answer some questions that the detectives had. The police asked OJ about a cut on one of his fingers on his left hand. And at first he told them that he had cut it when he was in the hotel room after he had just heard about Nicole's death. And, like, he went down to reception and asked for a band-aid and blah, 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 blah. But then when he was questioned about the blood in and on the Bronco, he changed his story to say that he'd cut his finger the day before, so the same day as the murders, but couldn't really remember how it happened. He just all of a sudden had a cut in his hand, which, I'm not gonna lie, that happens to me, so.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, and I guess maybe they couldn't do it then, but they could certainly do it now, did they test the blood on the car to see whose blood it was?
Oh yeah, no, I'll get into that.
Okay.
Don't you worry. So OJ voluntarily gave police a sample of his blood, and then he was let go home. The following day, OJ hired a very famous attorney, Robert Shapiro. Shapiro then set out to gather a dream team of lawyers to work on OJ's case, and this included one of OJ's closest friends, Robert Kardashian.
The one and only?
The one and only. The only Kardashian that ever had any decency. Shapiro also noted that he sent OJ to start getting treatments for depression that same day. On Wednesday, June 15th, the preliminary results of the blood samples from the scene of the crime and the ones that OJ gave were a match, but the district attorney wanted to wait until the full report had come through before making any sort of move. So on the Thursday, OJ spent the night in Robert Kardashian's house, where Shapiro had several doctors attend to OJ's mental state. On Friday, June 17th, 1994, police recommended to the district attorney that OJ be charged with 2 counts of murder in the first degree with special circumstances of multiple killing after the results of the DNA sample came back as a match with OJ's blood sample.
Okay, so the blood that was on the ground?
The blood that was at the crime scene matched OJ's blood sample.
Okay, so, like... With that, with you even saying that to me, that's literally 2 and 2 equals fucking 4. How is he not in prison? How do you have a lawyer that good?
I'll let you know. So before I go into the rest of this wild story, I'm about to get to the best bit. We'll take a short little ad break.
Whoop whoop.
Whoop whoop. And we're back. Hope you enjoyed it. Did you skip it?
Thank you for supporting us.
Thank you. So this is where, personally, it just gets wild AF. Okay. The LAPD notified Shapiro of the charges at 8:30 a.m. on Friday 17th of June 1994. Shapiro then went to go see OJ at Kardashian's house and informed him that he would have to turn himself into the police by 11 a.m. to surrender to the charges. Shapiro, OJ, and the LAPD all came to an agreement that would allow OJ to wait until 12 p.m. until he had to turn himself in to allow him to get his affairs in order.
Fair, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess so.
Mm-hmm. Because he had been cooperative, so they, you know, they weren't like all too concerned.
Yeah. Well, no, at the same time, he's being charged with first degree murders.
He's OJ, he's famous. So OJ changed his will and testament. He then called his mother and then he called his children. He wrote 3 letters, one to his mother, one to his children, and one to the public that was to be sent out after his arrest. As 12 p.m. neared, more than 1,000 media representatives arrived at the police station to try and catch OJ's perp walk. However, OJ never appeared at 12 p.m. as agreed. The police notified Shapiro that the police were being dispatched to the Kardashian household to arrest OJ. When a police arrived at Kardashian's home to arrest OJ about an hour later, it became known that OJ had actually fled the scene with a friend called Al Crowling in Al's very similar white Bronco. The LAPD had no other choice but to make a statement to the public announcing that OJ was officially a wanted fugitive. But then get this. At 5 p.m, Shapiro held a press conference in defiance of the LAPD, at which Kardashian read out the letter OJ had written to the public. So I'm not going to read out the whole letter, but I'll just give you a few snippets of it.
Oh, okay, cool.
So it started off with, "To who it may concern. First, everyone understand, I had nothing to do with Nicole's murder. I loved her. Always have. Always will." It then went on to say things like, "As a last wish, please, 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 please leave my children alone. Their life will be hard enough. And at times, I felt like a battered husband."
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Are you actually pulling my titty right now?
Man has no shame, because then he went on to say, "I'm sorry to the Goldman family. I know how much it hurts.
The absolute fucking neck of this man.
Right? I know. Get it together. He then went on to end it with, like, "Please think of the real OJ and not this lost person."
You absolute pansy. Imagine, like, backing out on an agreement that you have with the police. Like, you're famous already. Like, oh my God. You fucking pussy. Like,
I know.
You're not a man. You're not a man.
No.
You're an actual loser of the highest order. You fucking donkey.
Oh God, I love it. The police sent out helicopters in search of the white Bronco around the Los Angeles highway. people actually began spotting the Bronco on the highway and started calling it into highway patrol. And they actually eventually traced OJ's whereabouts through tracing a phone call he made to the LAPD. A police officer eventually caught up with the Bronco on the highway before having to pull back due to Al Crowling's shouting out the window to do so, as OJ was sitting in the back of the Bronco with a gun to his own head, asking Al to drive. So OJ later said that he was asking Al to bring him to Nicole's grave because he wanted to talk to Nicole.
That is so fucking disgusting. Like, even if you didn't kill her and, yeah, whatever, maybe, I don't know. But you beat the shit out of her and you made her life a fucking misery.
Have just some shame. Just give her peace and death. Yeah, literally. Absolutely horrific. So this actually ended up turning into a low speed car chase of 56 kilometers per hour with up to 20 police cars chasing the Bronco on the highway. Media coverage started to sprout up almost immediately. So an unbelievable amount of news channels sent out helicopters to cover, to get like camera footage of the low speed chase on the highway. And there was that many broadcasting it that it actually started to affect other channels. And it was almost on every channel in America, live.
No way.
Yeah, people began gathering at the overheads of the highway with signs that said, "Go OJ, go," which was taken from a commercial that he had done a few years previous. So this is 1994. 2 years previous to this, in Los Angeles in 1992, are what I would probably say are the first ever Black Lives Matter protests that were ever super big. So there was a lot of racial problems in America. I mean, there still are, but at this time it was especially bad. And so a lot of people felt like he was innocent and that the police were just trying to pin him because he was black. So a lot of them were like, "No, OJ, you get your freedom,"
It also astounds me that they just seen this shit happen on TV or got a phone call from a friend, went out and made a sign, and they're going so slow on the highway. They still had time to get out to the highway and put the sign over.
This low-speed chase went on for hours. A helicopter actually had to land because it was running out of fuel. It's wild. All radio stations began covering the story as well, and eventually through phone calls to the police, they figured out what radio station was on in the Bronco. The station got in contact with OJ's college football coach, who then rang OJ himself and pleaded with him to turn himself in, saying, quote, "My God, we love you, Juice. Just pull over and I'll come out and stand by you all the rest of my life." Off air, OJ promised, saying, quote, "Okay, coach, I won't do anything stupid, I promise." The police were in an absolute frenzy trying to get OJ to surrender himself peacefully, because obviously, they didn't want it to escalate. Do you know, they just, I mean, they were kind enough to give him an extra hour to get, to let him get his affairs in order before he had to come down to the police station. They were like, "Come on, fuck off, do it peacefully, man."
Yeah.
The detective who had interviewed OJ on the Monday after the murders remembered that he had been given OJ's number, so he began to call him repeatedly. Lang, the detective's name, pleaded with OJ to throw the gun out of the window for the sake of his mother and children. And OJ responded by apologizing for not turning himself in earlier in the day, and said, quote, "The only one who deserves to get hurt was me, and I'm gonna go with Nicole," end quote. OJ,
oh my God.
Dramatic. OJ then pleaded with Lang to just, quote, let me go to the house, and stated that, "I need the gun for me." When the Bronco pulled into OJ's estate, on the recording of the phone call, you can hear Al Crowling actually pleading with OJ to give himself up to the police peacefully. So it's estimated that 95 million people viewed the chase on the television. That is 5 million more than what actually tuned into the Super Bowl that year.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Once the Bronco had pulled into the Rockingham estate, OJ demanded that he be let go inside to talk to his mother in person. So the Bronco pulled in at 8 p.m. after 2.5 hours on the highway and an 80-kilometer chase. I have no words. OJ's...
I'm literally shocked. Like, I don't know what to say.
This is what I mean. It's fucking wild. OJ's son reportedly ran outside gesturing wildly at the SWAT men that were hiding all around the property to let his dad exit the car peacefully. It took OJ about 45 minutes for him to actually get out of the car holding a family photo when he finally
made
it. So
he took a family photo with him?
Yeah. Not just a family photo. When he finally made it inside of his home at 8:50 p.m., he spent approximately an hour talking with his mother. He had a glass of orange juice. That's funny.
I'm so, like, 5 years old.
And then Robert Shapiro arrived, and reportedly after a few minutes after he had arrived, OJ handed himself over to police. When Al's Bronco was searched, the police found $80,000 in cash, a disguise kit, including a fake mustache.
Stop it!
A change of clothes, an American passport, and family photos.
You are joking me.
OJ, you're one of the most famous people in the world at this stage of your life, and you think a pretend mustache is gonna hide you?
A fake mustache. Oh my god.
Like, you really can't make this shit up.
It's like, what is that thing? Where is Carmen Sandiego?
That's literally what it's like. It's fucking ridiculous. OJ was booked and was sent to Men's Central Jail, and per Al Crowlings, who was literally like, please, OJ, let me go home, was charged with harboring a fugitive, and his bail was set at $250,000.
That's not fair. That's not fair. Like, he's just a driver. If OJ had a fucking gun, there's nothing he could have done about it. Like, he's a hostage.
OJ never pointed the gun at him, but Al was scared that OJ would, like, try kill himself if he pulled over, and, like, he didn't want that on his hands, and, like, he wanted this to end as peacefully as fucking possible.
It's not fair on him. The man had a gun. Like, if somebody was around me with a gun, I'd probably shit myself and do whatever they told me to do.
Exactly. Exactly. None of this was ever actually represented at the trial, despite Marisha Clark, who was the prosecutor, saying that this implied guilt. She felt that the public's reaction to the Bronco chase meant that the trial had been compromised by OJ's celebrity status. This caused mixed views. Some people, including some of his own friends, felt like it was a mission of guilt by fleeing. And some felt like OJ felt like he had no choice, and like people sided with his actions.
No. No, sorry guys, no.
No. On June 20th, 1994, OJ was arraigned and he pleaded not guilty to both murders, and he was held without bail. The next day, a grand jury was called to decide if he should be indicted or not for the two murders, but on June 23rd, it was dismissed by Judge Kathleen Kennedy Powell.
Hi.
She dismissed it as a result of excessive media coverage. So she was like, there was too much media coverage. Like, it's going to be impossible to find impartial judges.
Impartial jury.
So on July 7th, Judge Kathleen Kennedy Powell ruled that there was sufficient evidence to bring OJ to trial. His bail was set for $10 million. And on July 2nd, at his second arraignment, when he was asked how he pleaded to the charges, OJ responded, quote, absolutely, 100% not guilty.
Are you sure? I don't know, maybe have a little think about that. Maybe think about that a little bit.
So, a witness testified that the night of the murders, she saw a white Bronco drive away from the direction of the scene of the crime. It was driving in such a hurry that it almost had a collision with another car, and the woman also stated that she heard a man's voice and she could have sworn it sounded like OJ Simpson. Unfortunately, this woman sold her story to the media for $5,000, and this meant that the prosecution couldn't use her testimony as she became an unreliable witness.
Yeah.
Another witness was able to provide receipts showing that OJ bought a stiletto knife 6 weeks before the murders. The knife was recovered and the coroner testified that it was similar to the markings on both bodies, but once again, the prosecution couldn't use this witness as he sold his story for $12,500.
What? What the f-
A guard at the prison in which OJ was in testified that a former friend of OJ's came to visit him, and at one point OJ shouted, "I didn't mean to do it," and the friend then encouraged him to come clean, but the judge dismissed this as it was hearsay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which I get the judge is doing his job, but fuck.
I know.
So OJ's defense team originally tried to say that a hitman for hire by drug dealers were the ones to blame for Nicole and Ron's murder, as the drug dealers were looking for a friend of Nicole's who owed them a lot of money for cocaine. The friend had been staying at Nicole's before she entered rehab 4 days before the murder, but the judge was like, you can't fucking use that. That is speculation.
Yeah.
Like, they literally had no proof or evidence to support this theory.
So you have nothing to support that at all. What are you doing?
Yeah. A housekeeper of OJ's neighbour testified that she saw OJ's Bronco outside his home at the time the murders took place. But when the prosecution cross-examined her, she revealed that she wasn't actually too sure what time she saw the Bronco. And when the prosecution went back through evidence, there was an interview from the same housekeeper the night of the murders, and she never once mentioned seeing the car. But had mentioned a second housekeeper. So the prosecution then went off and interviewed the second housekeeper, and she told them that the first housekeeper was lying and that the defense had offered them both $5,000 to say that they saw the Bronco there during the time of the murder.
Stop it. So as in the defense is in the lawyers or OJ himself?
The defense is in the lawyers, but acting on behalf of OJ. So the prosecution brought this to the judge, and the judge stated that the defense could use this housekeeper's testimony if they wanted, but all the other evidence that the prosecution had to go along with her testimony would be used. The defense dropped her from their list of witnesses. They were like, nah, hey. Lol, no, never mind. JK, got you.
You're funny.
Yep. OJ wanted a speedy trial, and the trial started 7 months after the murders on January 24th, 1995. It was also televised. The judge had started looking for jurors on October 1994 and finally found 12 jurors with 12 backups in November. And by the time the case was finished, only 4 of the original jurors remained.
Oh.
Yeah, like one juror had to be removed because like a week into the trial, it was revealed that she had been a victim of domestic abuse, and so, like, how was she to have a
unbiased opinion?
Yeah, so she was, like, let go. So it was, like, stuff like that had happened.
Okay.
Yeah. The prosecution believed that the jurors would sympathise with Nicole and the domestic abuse that she had endured, but the defence believed that because of the racial differences and the racial tensions that were happening at the time, that the odds would actually turn in their favour, because, I forget the, like, there was X amount, like, that were black and that were women, and then that were black women, and so they were like, black women aren't going to actually sympathise because Nicole was white. The defence was that black women wouldn't sympathise with a white woman's domestic abuse, just purely based on, like, race. Which I don't...
Yeah, that's horrific. Why would anybody think that? Like, a human is a human. If you're abused, you're abused.
I don't know. It's wild. Personally, the jury was sequestered for 265 days, which is the most in American history.
Okay.
So I'm about to start going into, like, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to, like, go into the prosecution and, like, what they had for evidence, and then I'm going to go into what the defense had for evidence, and then... The prosecution argued that the domestic violence that took place within OJ and Nicole's marriage culminated in him murdering her and Ron. OJ was reportedly angry with Nicole the night of the murders because at the daughter's recital, Nicole wore a very tight black dress that OJ disapproved of. Yeah. The prosecution claimed that OJ went over to Nicole's that night to reconcile with her, and when she refused, he killed her in one final act of control over her. when Ron entered the scene, in his anger, OJ killed him too. The prosecutor.
Yeah, I can see that.
I can see that too. Like, I get where they're coming from. The prosecution called one of the detectives to the stand who responded to one of her many 911 calls. And they also called one of Nicole's sister to the stand, who talked about witnessing OJ pick up Nicole in a row and hurl her towards a wall.
Jesus, in front of people too. Like, this man had no shame.
Literally no shame. The prosecution also used Cato Kalin, and he stated that, yeah, OJ was upset with Nicole the night of the murders. The judge, however, only allowed witness testimony on the domestic violence that Nicole endured to be used in court, so the journals that she had kept in the safety deposit box never got to be used in court.
What? That's a fucking joke. How did they get away with that?
I think they claimed something like hearsay, like she only wrote it, where witness reports full on witnessed it. Like her writing about it, it's like, oh, she could have, you know, fabricated.
Yeah, that was the whole point. She wrote the journals.
I know. Like, I was like, that poor woman went through so much violence and literally kept it all documented. And for what?
She did everything that you're supposed to do.
And it didn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. The prosecution also used the fact that they had the DNA matching OJ at the scene of the crime. They also had shoe prints at the scene of the crime, which belonged to a rare, expensive shoe sized 12. Only 29 pairs of these shoes were ever sold, one of which was sold in a shop in which OJ often visited. OJ denied owning a pair of those quote ugly ass shoes. An employee at the store did testify that he did show OJ the shoes, but there was actually no paper trail that could prove he bought them.
Right.
There was also Ron Goldman's blood inside the Bronco.
An actual slam dunk.
And Ron Goldman never knew OJ. Like, he would have never been in OJ's car. So the defense team, which was led by Robert Shapiro and then eventually led by Johnny Cochran, argued that the DNA the prosecution claimed to have was compromised, contaminated, and corrupt. Yeah. Yeah. So the route that the defense took was racism. So Robert Shapiro, from, like, stuff that I've watched, Robert Shapiro didn't want to go the racism route, but Johnny Cochran did. And OJ sided with Johnny Cochran because Johnny was like, there is racism in this. And, like, you know, this is what's going to work. And
yeah.
Yeah. So the defense had a doctor testify that OJ was not fit enough to carry out two murders because he had chronic arthritis and old football injuries. However, the prosecution had an exercise video of OJ taken weeks before the murder, showing that he was still fit and healthy. The doctor then admitted that, yeah, if OJ was in, quote, the throes of adrenaline, he could have committed murder. The defense then had a pathologist testify that the murders were actually closer to 11 p.m, which is when OJ was alibied for. He also said that Ron most likely fought for 10 minutes before dying. However, after the trial, the pathologist stated that he was wrong and that testifying for OJ was a mistake. So the...
Testifying for OJ was what? Was a mistake?
Yeah, to testify on, like, for the defense instead of for the prosecution was a mistake. Like, he was like, yeah, the prosecution were right. The murders were closer to 10 p.m. So people reckon that he just agreed to do it so that he could get his payday. Obviously, yeah, there's no proof of that, but just, yeah. The defense also claimed that all the blood that was found at the scene of the crime that supposedly belonged to OJ was planted in a conspiracy. The prosecution's pathologist testified that Ron Goldman's blood was inside the Bronco, but once again, the defense claimed that it was planted there by the police. See, they also proved that one of the detectives was a known racist and had used the N-word in previous cases.
Oh, not cool, okay.
And so they used that he just wanted to blame OJ because he was black, and then the other detectives went along with it in a cover-up. Like, okay. So basically what they were saying is that this one detective that was a racist went rogue and planted evidence, and so then the other police officers just went along with it to cover up and protect one of their own. So then the very last piece of evidence that the defense would use was the gloves found by police. So the gloves supposedly had to be frozen to preserve the blood on them and to preserve the DNA and stuff like that. However, in a turn of events, the judge allowed OJ to try them on for the jury. He had to put on protective latex gloves not to contaminate them, and then he had to try them on. The glove didn't fit OJ's hand, and this is where Johnny Cochran used his infamous line, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit," which he shouted and shouted and shouted all throughout the courtroom that day.
Dramatic bitch.
Yep. The prosecution had concerns, as OJ did have arthritis, and some of his medication was anti-inflammatory. And they had heard a rumour that OJ skipped taking the tablets the day before the fitting of the gloves so that his joints would swell, causing his hand not to fit the glove.
Also, if it's leather and it's been frozen, would that not cause some sort of, like, contracting of the leather? I don't know.
So the maker of the gloves actually testified that the gloves had actually shrunken from their original size, and then an extra large would indeed fit someone with OJ's sized hands. And he produced an extra large glove of the same make, and it was much bigger than the one that was found at the scene of the crime. And he was like, if it's an extra large, like the label says, like, that's not its original size.
Okay.
Interesting.
Indeed.
Indeed.
Indubitably.
So, at the end of the trial, as the trial was nearing the end and it was starting, like the day before the trial and stuff like that, the country was actually kind of scared and fearful that race riots would break out if OJ was found guilty. So the day of the verdict, police were put on 12-hour shifts, some of which were on horseback, and the president was actually briefed on how to handle it if there was riots. Like, they were proper, like, shit, if he's found guilty, like,
getting ready.
Yeah, because the OJ case had turned into this major race debate.
Yeah, okay.
Which, like...
And, like, that's a valid conversation to have, but at the end of the day, we're talking about domestic abuse and a violent, jealous man. There is a valid conversation to be had around that, but I don't think it's necessarily the root of the case at all. It's not the root of the case. Nicole is and Ron.
This case should have been just purely about what Nicole endured from OJ and how it turned massively violent. And I feel like Nicole and Ron were forgotten about, almost. Do you know, like, two people lost their lives.
Right, yeah, I get that.
Do you know, and, I agree with you, as you said, like, that, like, yes, race is an important conversation to be had. And, like, you know, how not to discriminate and, like, things that were being said, yes, were valid points and do happen to people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, on Tuesday, October 2nd, 1995, the jury came to a verdict. After 4 hours of deliberation, O.J. Simpson was acquitted of both murders. The verdict being read was televised, and as it was read, you could hear cheers all across the country. But at the same time, you could hear sighs of disbelief, as some people felt like the jury got it wrong. The country was in a massive divide about it. It is estimated that 100 million people listened and watched to the verdict being read. After OJ was released from prison, the police chief released a statement basically saying that they weren't going to look further for a murderer, and that just because OJ was acquitted, quote, it doesn't mean there is another murderer. So this angered OJ as he felt.
Sorry, repeat that for me there.
So the police chief released a statement basically saying that just because OJ was acquitted doesn't mean that there is another murderer to be found for this crime. Right. So this angered OJ as he felt like the police, you know, were like, nah, you did it. But he was like, I was found innocent. But so from what I could gather, basically OJ didn't really seem to understand that it wasn't that he was found innocent. It was that he was acquitted.
Yeah.
You know, but he felt like, oh, no, they found me innocent. And it was like, well, no, OJ, they didn't find you innocent. Do you know? In 1998, OJ was quoted in a magazine saying, let's say I committed this crime. Even if I did this, it would have been because I loved her, right?
Oh. Oh no. Oh no. Oh, even OJ. If you didn't do it, you should not look at the violent murder of your
ex-wife.
Wife, like, ex-wife.
Be like, and if her I friend. Did it, it would have been for love.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Oh, no, no, no. His life after the trial was never really the same, which it took him a while to understand. His friends always questioned if he was actually innocent or not, which Robert Kardashian was one of.
Mm.
So Robert Kardashian was in the room with OJ as the verdict was being read. And when you watch OJ's face, you can see he's like, did I just help an innocent? Like, you can, like, to me personally anyway, his facial expression reads like, did I just help a guilty man walk free? Like, do you know, like, he's almost in absolute shock and disbelief. Like, he's like, no, he should be arrested right now. What the fuck? Obviously, we'll never fully know what went through his mind. But to me, that's what his face reads. And I don't have actually any quotes, but I do believe that afterwards he was a bit like, I don't know anymore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think he was like, the prosecution did have valid points, but I have no actual quote, so...
Isn't it so interesting now that Kim is getting into that and Kim is, like, you know, studying law and trying to support prison reform and stuff like that? Like, she is following in her dad's footsteps.
Which, like, say whatever you want about her, at least, you know, she's trying to do something good for the world. You're like, sorry. That was wild. So the family of Ron Goldman sued OJ for wrongful death. And Nicole Bryant's family sued OJ for a survival suit. The families were awarded millions in this lawsuit, and the lawsuits found OJ, quote, responsible for the murders.
Stop!
Yep, OJ then was left with all sorts of bills after these trials, and Robert Shapiro actually claimed in later years that he never received his full payment from OJ.
No way!
Yeah, so then on September 13th, 2007... OJ led a group of men into a hotel casino in Las Vegas and robbed it at gunpoint.
Oh my, you know what? I'm quite surprised. Like, he was such a nice guy that I'm really surprised.
Right? Police interviewed him. He had said that he had never been at that casino, but then later changed his statement to saying that nobody had guns. However, the other, yeah. The other men had all agreed for plea deals and, like, you know, basically hung OJ out to dry.
Love it.
Love it. So OJ went to trial in 2008 after pleading not guilty to the charges. And he was found guilty and he was sentenced to 33 years with the possibility of parole after 9. So OJ served his 9 years and then applied for parole, which he got and was released on October 1st, 2017. And he is now, sadly, a free man. And just a little...
Sorry to interrupt you, but the people on the parole board, that man walked in there with a gun. He is suspected of having killed 2 people and in 2 lawsuits was found to be responsible for their deaths. So... who is letting him out on parole?
Right. So, in the year 2006, like the year before he robbed the casino, OJ did an interview and was planning on releasing a book called If I Did It, where he talks about how he murdered Nicole, Brian Simpson, and Ron Goldman in a hypothetical scenario. A judge, however, declared that OJ couldn't make money off the crimes, and it was never released until 2018, where it was released, but in a different sort of setting. So they released the interview that he did, but what it was they had one of the prosecutor lawyers watch the interview, and they had, like, specialists and stuff watch the interview and comment on it and talk about it, and you can actually find the full interview on YouTube. And when I tell you, this man murdered his ex-wife and her friend, he's in his quote hypothetical being like, I remember grabbing a knife from under the
he does not seat. Say I remember.
He says I remember. And then he's like, the interviewer, like, asks him a question and he's like, oh, I don't recall. Bro, if it's a hypothetical, you make it up.
Yeah, I don't recall. What the fuck?
Yeah. Like, and he literally is like, I did, and I did, and I was, and I saw, and I felt. And then at the end of it is like, this is of course all hypothetical.
Are you sure? I feel like you're not sure, but okay.
Yep. So that was the sad murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman.
Yeah, so now I can say this. This case was fucking wild. I knew that OJ was a free man, and I knew that he'd killed his girlfriend. I knew that he killed Nicole and Ron, but I didn't know, I knew about the glove, obviously that's super famous, but I didn't know what the story was with, the rest of the case or anything like that, so... Christ on a fucking bike. That's nuts.
I know, yeah. Yeah, so I find it so bizarre that they had so much evidence, but then there was so much of it that they actually couldn't use in court. And I feel like if they had been able to use it, then they would have gotten the conviction. And And the prosecutor, the lawyer that was on the prosecution team that appeared in the document in the interview, he says, he is, this man murdered this woman. And he was it angered me for so many years because I felt, responsible for, letting him away with it, for not doing a good enough job to get the conviction.
Right.
And, the interview, OJ is, victim blaming a lot of the time.
Of course he is. That's his whole mindset. He's a domestic abuser. He's an abuser. He's just a fucking... piece of shit. So he's gonna blame anyone but himself for being a piece of shit.
Literally. And in the interview, he's after she died, I was so angry with her. I was like, well, what were you angry with her for? Literally, what are you angry at her for? Get a life.
She was brutally murdered. I've heard of people being angry at, loved ones that have passed for leaving them and, leaving them behind and that kind of thing. But I don't think this is that situation.
No, absolutely not. It's insane. So that was my OJ case.
Thank you very much for enlightening me. That's great.
Yes. And look, everybody, it's not going to sound the same like it does in most weeks.
It might sound better.
I highly doubt it. I am not technically advanced enough to set up fucking recording. You should have seen me earlier. I was getting so stressed trying to get shit to work. So.
Yeah, it's fucking horrible. I remember when we first started this and trying to get it set up on the computer. Remember when we were out in your garage and
God.
I would lose my shit for half an hour before every episode trying to just set a fucking mic up.
Yeah, no, it's easy, but... at the same time, it's not easy. And also, I'm in my kitchen. There's an echo. I'm pretty sure at some stage you're going to hear a call going upstairs to Anna because she stirred.
Well, no, it's whatever. It is what it is. We're all doing our best here at home.
Exactly. Look, let's just do what we got to do for a little while so that we can go back to having the time of our lives.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so...
Yeah, so socials? I really hope everybody enjoyed this episode. If you did, you can go follow us on our social medias, which is our Instagram and Twitter, which are both at GiveUsMorgue. You can also, if you fancy it, follow us personally. If you're like, who the heck am I listening to? Well, you can go check it out. Megan is at MegPowell_, and I am at Mrs_Neve. And you can also check our website out, which is giveusmorgue.com. And if you have any suggestions on who you'd like us to talk about next, or if you just have any, in general, recommendations about anything, documentaries, things like that, anything you'd love us to check out, you can email us at giveusmorgue@gmail.com.
For show.
And hey, if you'd feel like it, you could leave us a review on wherever you listen to your podcast. That would be
oh my god, a review would be so fucking sexy. You should totally do it. Do it. You sexy little minx. Go on.
Do it. I swear.
I swear. Straight fire.
Straight fire. That's our new thing apparently. So thanks everybody. I'll see you next week, and hopefully I'll sound a bit better. I'll get better at it, I promise.
We are on it like a car bonnet.
Oh my god, I haven't heard that phrase in literal years. Okay.
All right.
Bye.
All right, guys. We'll see you next week. Bye. Bye. Bye.